Welcome to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast with your hosts, Dr. Amandeep Hansra, Dr. Dana Pung, and myself, Dr. Elise Putt. Join us as we talk to inspiring clinicians who have redefined their careers. Today, we welcome Dr. Stephen Gluckman onto the podcast. He is the co-founder and director of Toga Health, where they're creating innovative models for healthcare in the psychiatry space. Steve has an MBA from MIT and was previously the medical director at Human Health. He also sits on a number of boards, including the Australian Society for Medical Entrepreneurship and Innovation, Friends of Sheba Hospital, and the Choice Foundation. I really enjoyed this chat, and I hope you do too. Hi, Dr. Steve Gluckman. Welcome to the Creative Careers and Medicine podcast.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Can you give us a little bit of a rundown of what you're currently working on?
Absolutely. I am currently a director at Toga Health, which is a new company that I've set up with a friend of mine to change the way that mental health services are delivered in Australia. It's one of the hats that I wear, but probably one of the hats that I'm most excited about at the moment.
And when you say you wear multiple hats, what other things are you doing at the moment?
I like to do a few things, and I'm really fortunate and really privileged that I get to wear a few hats across my community space, across the business world and in the clinical world. Probably most importantly, I know my wife will probably be listening to this, is the new dad role that I've taken on. I'm a dad to a four-week-old little boy called Elliot, which is definitely the coolest job that I get to do at the moment. So the director and co-founder of a new mental health business called Toga Health. I sit on the board of a few community organizations that all have a little bit of crossover in this space. A really great one's called the Choice Foundation, which is a social empowerment organization for people with special needs and in the mental health space. I also sit on the boards of Australia Friends of Sheba, which is one of the most innovative hospitals in the world, and the Australian Society for Medical Entrepreneurship, which is very relevant. And in my spare time, I still like to do a bit of locuming in the emergency department after hours CMO at a rehab hospital.
Amazing. I feel like that's a lot of hats, and congratulations. on your little one. That's very exciting.
Thank you.
And impressive that you're able to do the other bits alongside that at the moment as well.
You know, it's interesting. Just before he came and we were at the start of forming quite an ambitious business, I was quite anxious about how I was going to divide my personal time with my work time. And a friend of mine who runs a VC overseas said that each time he had his children, he became more productive in his work because you stop measuring your time in terms of days and hours and you start measuring in terms of minutes of availability. Throwback to last night reviewing notes for a meeting this morning while I was burping my child over my shoulder. So I think that it definitely takes some time, but it makes you a lot more efficient and puts things into perspective.
Yeah, I'm sure. Now, I want to get into Toga Health and hear a little bit about that. But first off, I want to talk about your journey into medicine in the first place. Do you remember when you first started to think about a career in medicine?
The first time I started to think about a career in medicine was probably when I told my mum that I wanted to be an actor. It was probably in about year nine, and I, believe it or not, was quite a shy kid and had found my confidence in being on stage and had got a lot of positive affirmation, winning a few iSteadfords here and there. And so lo and behold, decided I was going to be the next Tom Cruise. Pleased to find out he wasn't that tall either. So I thought, okay, there's a role for me out there. And then when I told my mum, she didn't blink twice. And she said, that sounds great, but go and get a medical degree first. So I think you get your first foray in work experience. And I remember going to the SAN, which is a really great private hospital in Sydney's North Shore. I actually did most of my medical schooling there as well. And I can tell you about that. And got to know some of the consultant surgeons. In year 10 as a 16-year-old, I did my first faint in an obstetrics procedure. My skin toughened from then on and thought to myself, wow, if I can work my way up to surgery, this is the coolest thing I'd ever seen. And so that was really the beginning for me.
Yeah, wow. I'm surprised that didn't put you off surgery at that age. I actually didn't realize we had both of those things in common. In year 9, I wanted to be an actress. And in year 10, I did my work experience at the SAN as well.
Oh, no way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the SAN's great. And it was also my clinical school for during university, which gave you a great connection to the consultants. And they've got a great model where you've got medical students and consultants and not a lot of registrars or residents in between. And so the consultants get this incredible sense of giving back, which is something that's quite rare in the private sector. But I was listening to a few of the other CCIM podcasts. It's incredible to hear how many other CCIM members wanted to be actors at some point. There's probably something that you could get on this psychoanalysis couch and dig into that somewhere. I don't know what that means.
Yeah, some indwelling creativity.
That maybe
got stamped out through medical school and then reemerges.
And here we are. back for more.
So how did you go from that work experience, high school, thinking about doing med to getting in, applying for med? Did you go straight from school?
Yeah, so I was quite lucky in that I got into the University of Sydney's combined medical program. It was a function of two things, really. One, I had moved around a lot as a kid. I think I'd been to 7 or 8 different schools. I'd lived in 21 houses. I was originally born in South Africa. And when you move around in different schools as a kid, you sort of get good at trying to understand the people around you because you really try to fit in. And as you move into a lot of different environments, you start to think, okay, well, what is it about this group of people that's going to help me be accepted? How am I going to fit in here? Are my people here? And I became really fascinated with what drives people, what motivates them to do certain behaviors. And when you're a kid, it's around what's going to make me cool in front of these other people. And then what I became to see, and what maybe what I romanticized about medicine, was you started to see the pieces of people's life that drove them to do behaviors that affected their health. And so for me, all the surrounding, the art side of medicine, what it meant to be human, what drove people, why did you want to get well when you were sick in the first place? Was it mere survival? Or was there something more to life? I think that was so fascinating for me. And then I loved a bit of a challenge. And so you add in the anatomy, the physiology, the biology, which I had done none of in high school. I'd done all Englishes and drama. And all of a sudden, science was on the table. I thought, this is a challenge that I want to get my hands around. And so medicine became this sort of perfect balance between art and science. And so Sydney Uni, the program lets you choose an undergrad and you go into postgrad. And so I chose neuroscience because this was the closest thing to understanding the way people made behaviors. Neuroscience is a very anatomical based study, and you think you can understand things purely by imaging and neurochemicals. And yet the philosophy and the art side of medicine, there's really so much more. You really have to blend these two worlds. And so ended up going and doing postgrad med, which is a great experience because you're in there with people who've come from a whole range of different backgrounds as well. I think in my first PBL, which is that problem-based learning group, I had someone who'd been an Air Force pilot, a couple of international students. And I thought to myself, this is exactly where I want to be. I've got so many different perspectives around the table. This is definitely a place I'm going to learn. And so that's how I got into medicine.
How did you go from, because you talked about wanting to do surgery when you were in your work experience, to then you're now working in a psychiatry space. Oh. And you talked about things that sound psychiatry focused interesting you in your undergrad. What were you thinking at the end of med school in terms of where you wanted to head with your career?
I think I had read Oliver Sacks, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, as an undergraduate, and decided that the brain was where I was going to head. I thought it was so fascinating. I thought the ambiguity was unreal. And then, like I said, I was at the SAN and saw an incredible model for the private healthcare system, which none of my other peers who were at RPA or Westmead were experiencing, where this hospital had an incredible amount of funding and therefore had a lot of innovation. And so I remember when Google Glasses came out as a medical student, we had quite an enthusiastic anaesthetist who was there showing us how he was working with startups and Google Glass. And I kept thinking, wow, you could do that as an anaesthetist. That's brilliant. I wonder how I would take that to mental health. And because I was at a private hospital in the North Shore, I needed other experiences. So I went out to Dubbo for a year and spent some time in the bush, which was incredibly eye-opening. And I did a psychiatry rotation about 2 hours outside of Dubbo, thinking to myself, this is it. I found my calling, and had quite an interesting counter-transference experience, which is when some of the emotions that a patient might be experiencing is projected onto the person taking the history. And it can be quite confronting. A lot of great psychiatrists out there would understand that it's actually part of the therapy. And if you have that experience, it might actually make you a great psychiatrist yourself. But when you're in the middle of the bush and you're left alone and you're fight or flight shaking, I thought to myself, I needed to go the complete other direction, needed certainty, needed something a bit more lighthearted. And so my next rotation was during ped surgery at Westmead Children's Hospital. And I remember doing a ward round in a onesie and thought to myself, this is it. This is exactly where I need to be. And as most people out there who've started gunning surgery, I started studying for my GCSEs. I started doing some research with one of the pediatric surgeons out there, and that defined my pathway for the next few years until I was an SRMO at Sydney Children's Hospital. planning a pediatric surgery career and thinking this was it. Like when you're in internship and residency, you sort of get attracted to the people that you most gel with. You choose your specialty based on where you find your people. I thought I had found that in pediatric surgery, but really when I look back, wherever there was team-based care, like really great team-based care, I had the best time. My geriatrics term, I absolutely loved. I really loved the palliative care time. I loved pediatric surgery. I loved being in outpatient clinics where you had so many multidisciplinary teams working together. Push came to shove and it was PGY3 and I was staring down what it might look like to go down a surgical training pathway. And that harrowing and myopic pathway, which it sort of beats you into the other side. I look back and thought, what were the things that I loved about all of those great rotations? And you've probably seen this, when you're in a ward and the nursing staff, everyone's in a good mood, there's an energy on that ward and patients tend to get better care. They're probably attended to faster. They're attended to with smiles on their faces. People are more willing to say yes to junior doctors. When family and friends come onto the ward, they're usually met with a really smiling face. It creates a great atmosphere. And it's that superpower that I was really attracted to. There's only so many times you can bring, you know, a bag of snakes onto a ward to improve everyone's mood. And don't get me wrong, that goes a long way. But I thought to myself, if I'm going to go down surgical training, where am I going to get the skills to scale that superpower? And I wasn't sure I was going to be able to do that. So I started looking elsewhere.
Yeah. Tell me where you started looking and what you were thinking of as alternate options at that point in time.
Yeah. So it was about halfway through my PGY3 year. And there I was thinking I was living the dream. I had the most incredible mentors, the most incredible registrars. I was taking out appendixes on my own. I think I'd done my first solo operation, which was a fecal impaction. Well, that's a story for another time. And I mentioned before that I stood on the board of the Choice Foundation. And so during high school, I started working on a project that was social camps for kids with special needs. And it's something I still continue to this day. It's sort of grown into young adult and also includes mental health now as well. And it's become a lot more about social empowerment. What I spend my time doing as a volunteer is inspiring other volunteers to be the best that they can be and really care for their community in really great ways. When you can galvanize people to do their best, you get the synergistic reaction. People enjoy giving their best. And it's hard to find in healthcare, particularly to these days when people tend to be a lot more burnt out and there's a cognitive dissonance because we've all felt what it's like to give our best. And we all seek those moments as clinicians where you can sit across from someone or you can inspire a junior or you can inspire a patient to change their behaviors. To me, it's not enough that I was going to incidentally have those experiences. I wanted to be involved in creating spaces or creating moments where those instances were more likely. I thought that if I was seeing these instances as something that was really powerful, that was going to be the work that I wanted to do. How could I get my peers and my colleagues and other clinicians out there who want to give their best, how could I give them the best chance in the best environments as to give of themselves? But I thought that the skills that you need to do that were not something that was available to be in med school. And it was not something that I was going to pick up incidentally doing surgical training. I think around PGY4, I decided I was going to start doing other things. And I had my first foray with startups, which was with a company called MedApps. I think most clinicians in New South Wales, I think in Queensland as well, probably use MedApps when they're in the public system. It's an incredible startup started by Rob Perlman and Tom Collins. And, you know, huge shout out to them for giving me that first opportunity. And I think you had Annie McHale on here a few episodes as well. It was also her first foray and I met her for the first time there. And started to see that there were tools that I could have, economic tools, funding tools, business operation tools, that if I was able to build on that toolkit, I might be able to see the problem that I was looking at in a different way and really have the change that I wanted to make.
Can I ask how you actually got that opportunity with MedApps? How did that go about?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. And I think it probably comes down to the way most of the opportunities that came this way. And it's by starting to speak to people. You've obviously got the CCAM podcast where you've got some of the best people out here who've done the most crazy things. You just reach out to these people and everyone's looking for good help. I think at the time, I don't even think MedApps was looking for help. I had reached out to Rob and probably found him online as a clinician who had done something differently. And he saw in me a spark that I think he had felt himself once upon a time. He'll say to me to this day, there wasn't a role there for me. They brought me along for the ride and put me on the product team. I know you've had a couple of people on here talking about product management, but it's gives you quite a broad perspective of what they do in startups. I wasn't there for long, maybe about 6 or 7 months, But during that time, it gave me the space and the confidence to go out and explore what were other doctors doing? How were other doctors seeing problems like this? Are the colleges the only way to go? Or is there another way that I could use this immense passion and skill that I developed, you know, over 7 years in med school? MedApps was great. In fact, my first day on the jobs at MedApps, they gave me a book called Traction. It's a how to run a startup book. They all made a bit of a joke about it. But a year ago when we started up Toga Health, I brought out the Traction book, and you better believe that the whole company is now run on the same book that I got from MedApps, which is pretty cool.
Did you continue clinical work alongside that at that point, or had you stepped away from, I'm talking full-time clinical work?
Yeah, so I dipped in and stepped away when different time have allowed. There's certain parts where I've had to step away for longer periods of time. So I went to the States and did my MBA for 2 years during COVID and decided at that time that I wasn't going to go back to clinical medicine. I think it was sitting at a hedge fund management class, looking around, hearing about the salaries that the peers around me were expecting to be on a few years from then. I thought to myself, I was doing the wrong job. But then I came back to Australia and I stepped back into the clinical space and to varying degrees. So when I moved away from pediatric surgical time, I got a part-time job doing rehabilitation CMOing, which let me keep my general skills up while doing MedApps. And since I've come back and I've worked in digital health and even now in Toga Health, I spend a bit of time once or twice a month in emergency departments doing locuming work, where I feel I've got a really appropriate level of supervision, but also get to flex on a whole range of different skills. It's great to feel like a generalist. It's also really important, I think, to keep your finger on the pulse in some way. Emergency for me has been a great way to do that. I know a lot of people, had Norman Swan on here recently, spoke about getting your letters as a great way to do that. I don't think you have to do that in order to know what it feels like to be a part of the system and to understand the problems of the system. I think that it's just a different perspective.
Did that feel like a big decision at the time to go from having worked full-time clinically to then going?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
What sort of things were you thinking and what informed that decision as well?
You don't spend 7 years visualizing yourself in a certain way, people telling you that that is the right way to be, and getting so much social affirmation to know, oh, you're going to be the doctor, or then, oh, you're going to be the surgeon, to at some point turn around and say, you know what, I actually see my future differently. It's terrifying. It requires a lot of courage. At the time, there were a few role models around me, not as many as I could find now in the creative careers space. But at the time, there were a few people I'd spoken to, Mike Bonning, Trung Ton, Amandeep Handra, people who had stepped away and had incredible careers. I think the first person I spoke to was the chief medical officer from Qantas, who had gone into occupational medicine. And just realizing that the walls that I had put up around this identity weren't as strong as they needed to be, and actually would be okay if I stepped away for a little bit and came back if I needed to. I think there's a lot of fear in stepping away, but what people don't realize is that you've got your medical degree, you've done the hard work. You can take some time away and it'll be there for you. You might have to upskill a little bit more when you come back. The space is always changing, and that's part of the exciting thing about coming back. And I think that what I was hearing when I was in PedSurg at the time, and I was talking about going and doing my MBA, was how exciting the consultants were for me to come back and share that experience with them. And so I think that recognizing that the value that you can create as a clinician is in the different experiences that you've had, it produces this really great synergy that produces unparalleled value, regardless of what you do, whether you come back and you're a consultant, but you've got, you know, an arts or a history degree or significant business experience that you bring to your private practice or medical administration. I think it doesn't have to be so linear. The sooner I came to that, the sooner I had the confidence to sort of take the leap.
That's so great that you had people around you that were supporting it as well and sort of saying, this will be advantageous to us, you coming back with this experience. Because I think that is what stops a lot of people from branching out, is that the people that they're around question them, which is probably coming more from the place of, this is not what I did to get to wherever I am now, so you can't go about it some different way to me. And maybe a bit of jealousy as well, because it sounds like a very fun and interesting experience that I'm keen to hear more about in terms of going and doing your MBA in the States. What was that decision? What led you to go to the States? And what time are we talking about as well? Because you said over COVID, were you there before COVID started?
I was there in the heat of it. We went over to Boston for 2 years, 2021 to 2022. So right in the thick of the COVID pandemic. The MBA justification really was about that toolkit. At the time, I saw the MBA as a way of expanding my understanding of the way the world worked. I wanted to understand how economic decisions were made. I wanted to understand how funding structure had affected social organizations. I really thought that so much of healthcare and the way that healthcare is delivered is governed by these realms that I knew nothing about. And whether I wanted to jump into that space or not, I felt remiss of me not to upskill in it. And so I thought that a degree was a great way to do that. I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I thought taking some time, and that this was 2 years, was actually quite an attractive thing to me. And medicine doesn't give you the opportunity to do exchange, and healthcare is a universal experience. And I wanted to see whether there were lessons that I could take from a global perspective and bring those back. I think getting into MIT was probably a bit of a fluke, something I'm quite grateful for. If anyone knows how involved applying to one business school is, I applied to about 9. I think I got rejected from Harvard and Stanford initially. Thought to myself, surely I'm a doctor, I'll get in here. But there's a lot of doctors who get MBAs out there these days. And I'm lucky I got into MIT. I found my people there. It's a school that is probably defined by a few key elements. One, they're all very quantitative and data-driven, which I was more of a big picture person. So that was a good learning. Some of the best at STEM in the world. So they're science, maths, and engineering. If you think of Tony Stark and Iron Man, I think he was an MIT professor in the movie. That's my nerd coming out. But I think the coolest thing about being over there, the greatest experience of stepping away from clinical medicine, is there are people there tackling really big problems. And there is no expectation that you can tackle any of these big problems on your own. As soon as you enter a room, you better believe you're not the smartest person in that room. But if you work together on a big problem with some of the great minds around you, and you bring people from engineering, you bring people from Harvard across the road who've done policy, you bring people from government, the way to see problems and the way to tackle some of the big problems we're facing today become a lot more clear. And I think that principle has really defined the way I've seen problem solving from here on in. So it's not about, you know, when you're in medicine, you have to wait until you've got the right expertise and you've done it 10,000 times before someone gives you the scalpel. And there's obvious reasons for that. But if you're going to have real big lasting innovation and tackle some of the big problems that our healthcare system is facing today, why not you? Why not now? And you better believe you're going to have to collaborate with the people around you to get there. That was a really great experience doing that.
Yeah, I think that's a great learning. And it would have been such an interesting time to be in the States as well, as much as I'm sure it was a really hard time to be on the other side of the world from all your loved ones.
Yeah, I mean, the US, particularly Boston, which is their rules, it was open, completely open. So we were in person the entire time, and they had a clever pod system that when someone inevitably got COVID, they closed a pod down, but the rest of the school continued on in-person lecturing. I did happen to get COVID a few times because of that, but I'm still here. You know, it's tricky, and people got quite sick actually during that time. But just before I left, I was working. I got a great job. Talk about weird jobs. We had just implemented our travel restrictions in Australia, and New South Wales Health was running the assessment team at Sydney Airport. And I got a job to be part of the clean team, which was basically one team from a certain district took a history and another team from another district did the swabbing. And I basically got to don full PPE, go onto the tarmac with the army and biosecurity, board planes because someone had a sniffle on a plane and I had to do a quick assessment. I mean, what a weird time we were in, but that was a cool experience.
And then coming back from the US, did you come back with a really clear idea of what you wanted to do or with a role lined
Absolutely
up?
Not. I think there's such an emphasis on having clarity over what your next, your five-year goals, your 10-year goals are, that people get so hesitant to take the first step and experience something. So I thought that sometime during the MBA, I'd figure things out. And I flirted with a whole range of different things. Like I said, I thought I was going to get into hedge fund management. There was a lot of doctors with MBAs who go into pharma. There were a lot of doctors who were buying out clinics and moving into the private equity space. I think the first step was realizing where we wanted to be geographically, and family came first. And so my wife at the time was not keen on the minus 30 degree Februarys. And so we decided to move back to Australia, which limits your options a little bit. The healthcare marketplace is slightly different here. And then wanted to keep things broad. I actually got into BCG at the time, which was seen as quite a hard thing to do and was going to give you a lot of great generalist training, and the salaries were really good. The people were amazing. And then a new opportunity came across the table, which a friend of mine was an investor in an early stage startup called Human, and said that there were some incredible founders that were ex-Canva and they had just cleared their first seed round and you should speak to them. And so I spent a year and a half nearly as their medical director, and what an incredible experience that was before jumping into Toga Health.
Well, this is where we met at Human. I'm keen to hear a bit more about how it actually came up for you and your experience of that, especially through the lens of we hear so many people, I feel like even more so in the juniors coming through med school now as well, wanting to get into digital health. I hear that talked about pretty broadly. So digital health and startups. What was that experience working at Human and how did it fit the picture that you had from the outside as well? What does the role actually look like when you're in it?
I think the first thing to note is we are living through a time right now where the amount of capital, the amount of resources, your ability to create change and to contribute to innovation has never been greater. And so the swings that are happening in so many different spaces are really, really exciting. And there's never been a better time, whether it's through an internship, which is where we met at Human, whether it's through a part-time job or whether it's through a full-time job. I think I still stand by getting involved in innovation, whether it's digital health, whether it's drug development, whether it's building a hospital like we're doing now. I think the reason I chose Human and I didn't go down the corporate pathway was navigating the ambiguity, navigating funding landscapes, navigating new ideas and bringing new things to market is a skill that I thought was going to be universal wherever I went. And here was a really exciting problem, like a really, really exciting problem. A really ambitious founder team and an incredible culture. And I think throughout my time at Human, I realized that those are the things that get you through those really ambiguous times is to focus on culture, to focus on what gets a team out of bed in the morning, what makes them excited to come and spend their time on a problem that is really hard, that you can't see what the other end is. You know, in medicine, we focus so much on outcomes. We focus so much on scientific evidence. And yet in the startup space, you need to make decisions without all the right information. And Human did that really well. They realized that if you're going to do it, you're going to do it as a team. And so we spent a lot of time working on culture and values. And that's something that I've taken into what we're doing at Toga Health today. I think the other thing is acknowledging that there is no problem too big to tackle. We collaborated during that time with some of the greatest minds, and they still do collaborate with some of the greatest minds across the US, across Australia on this problem. And I think if you're going to solve a problem like bridging the healthcare data gap between research, clinicians, and patients, the first step is saying that you're going to do that. The next step is getting the funding. And the last step is building out the relationships in order to make that change. And that's what we did in the year that happened. I think for me, what started in digital health, what started in MIT and has really played out to today, and it's why I'm working on Toga Health, was the thesis that there is so much opportunity, so much capital flying into the digital health space. You mentioned the drug development space. And if we don't have great places for the clinicians, for the patients, for the communities to interact with these technologies, with these innovations, if you don't have great clinics where we spoke before about those inspired nursing stations or inspired wards that can have a real impact on change, I think the real power is having those organizations, those real spaces, and then bringing the innovation into those spaces. And for me, I realized it wasn't the tech that I wanted to work on. It was the moments to bring that tech in. And that's how Toga Health got started.
Yeah. So tell me about Toga. Can you give me your elevator pitch for Toga Health?
The elevator pitch for Toga Health. Absolutely. Toga Health is a new business with a very bold mission to change the way mental health services are delivered in Australia. We come from a great two-tiered system where our public and private systems offer a great range of services, a great access to a whole range of services, and all different stakeholders across both of those spaces are pouring money in. I mean, if we were at the AFR Healthcare Summit recently, we heard about the health insurers delivering a significant money to the mental health sector, the government pouring a significant amount of resources into community mental health. I think we're at an unprecedented, you know, arguably a once in a generation time, and we've got a pretty unique opportunity, an infrastructure that brings together all of these resources across so many different stakeholders and deliver really unparalleled value to patients struggling with mental health, to their families that are really struggling with trust and not knowing where to go, to the clinicians who you only have to pick up a paper to realize that clinicians are looking for a new way to engage with patients, to engage with new innovations. And we at Toga have got a clean slate that has been trusted to us by the Toga Group to develop a new model of care, to design and build a new mental health campus which we are in the throes of doing as we speak, and to roll out a range of clinics that we believe will deliver, again, a great experience and great outcomes for patients, families, and clinicians.
Now, I don't know how much of this you're able to answer to at the moment.
We can give it a go.
But where are you actually up to at the moment in terms of, you said that you're building, you've got physical sites and you're actually under construction. Is that what you mean you're building, or are you designing programs? What sort of things are we building?
Yeah, so I think it's important to note that Togo is a multi-generational family business. It's been around for about 60 years and they're synonymous with hospitality. So if you look up Togo, you'll find hotels, you'll find apartments, you'll find restaurants and mixed use developments, but you'll find really beautiful places for people to come together and to gather and meet and stay. And when we came to Togo with this idea that, you know, we needed to bring some hospitality to the healthcare sector where you could create a great environment to bring the best of innovation, to build a great place for clinicians to be and really provide the environment for clinicians to do what they do best. Those moments of inspiration that we spoke about before, you know, how might we do this? They were inspired. And obviously the mental health piece is something that touches everyone directly, if not indirectly. And so they invested in us, my business partner, Jonathan and I, to spend the last year traveling the world and understanding where have models of care, where has design, where has technology got it right in the mental health space? It took us all across North America, been all through the Middle East, all through Europe, and all over Australia, and developed a bit of a thesis around where we think the best model of care fits within an Australian context. A few months ago, we acquired our first site, which was the old Wesley Mission Ashfield campus, and we are currently in the throes of working with international and local experts across clinical medicine, across peer working, across design, to design a mental health campus that can bring to life this model of care, which is really exciting. And so we're looking at a few years before that campus is off the ground and opening doors. And in the meantime, we've got this incredible opportunity and we're inviting collaboration with some clinicians who really want to have that sort of change in the mental health space to come and work with us at the moment on how we can take that model of care into satellite sites and clinics. And so we are expecting to open our first private practice specialty clinic in the eastern suburbs, one in Sydney, and we're looking at other states as well.
Amazing. It feels very timely as well. I mean, I know you're working on this before I caught wind of the mass resignation of psychiatrists, but I'm sure you were more tapped into what was going on in that landscape than I was. So it feels like a very opportunistic time to be innovating in the space.
There's so many good things that our system does. If I think about my own experience, one of the reasons I'm doing this, I had a best friend, I still have a best friend, and a first cousin who were both diagnosed with a psychotic disorder and have seen how at the really pointy end of the spectrum, they're caught by our public system and, you know, how incredibly grateful that they are for a safety net like that to be able to go there. And that's being threatened at the moment. It's over-resourced. And I've also been the emergency doctor where patients come in, you know, after swallowing a whole box of paracetamol. And you have to tell them that their risk profile is not high enough to be admitted and you turn them around. At the other end of that, I've got friends and immediate family members who've been to the GP and their second antidepressants not working, or the side effects of their third antidepressants mean that they're not meaningfully engaging in the world around them. And so we've listened to the clinicians who say they wish they could do more, who say that, you know, we're so stretched right now, we can only deliver this specific point, who say that if you build too nice of a building, you're going to do more damage than good because you're going to incentivize hospitalization. And I think through our travels, we've heard those clinicians and we've come back and we think that by taking the best of hospitality, by taking the best of what I've seen in innovation and building an infrastructure for that, the system that we can create really can offer something to those people who are falling through the gaps, and hopefully offer a sense of hope to their families and the clinicians that want to work in that kind of environment.
I'm interested in your learnings from your trips to look at these other facilities. And again, you don't have to reveal any secrets, but if you can answer, what was something that you found in your travels? What was your favorite thing that you feel like we're not doing in Australia that you saw somewhere overseas?
It's not that something's better overseas and Australia is not the best. Some of the best measurement-based care systems I've seen in Perth, some of the most incredible integrations between public and private systems, Australia does it better than anywhere else. So I think firstly, just to note, the Australian system is incredible. And like any system, there's opportunities for improvement. So I think we've got a really great starting base. We talk a lot about this push in digital health, about technology coming in. And a lot of clinicians feel the threat of technology. But there's insights that you can get through trusting relationships that you won't be able to get from purely technology solutions. And so as we move into this more transactional model of healthcare where you can pick up your phone, you can do a symptom check, and you can see your prescriptions, I think what we've seen in certain communities where their relationships with families or the community models of care are more emphasized is that you can get certain data points and insights that can help people with prevention or help people with adherence to behavioral change a lot better. If you think about diagnosis, we're taught that diagnosis is 80% history. And you would know so much more about a patient if you could look inside their home or look inside their fridge than just from taking a picture right there. And sure, you'll get some smart fridge or some AI thing that can summarize that, but you can't replace a trusting relationship. And so central to what we're trying to do here is put those relationships back in time to give those clinicians the time and the space, whether that's using technology or business ops, have those relationships and to see more than just the questionnaire. I think some of the other really cool things we saw in the Middle East and in Alaska were community-based models of care where you were able to understand patients so much beyond just the biopsycho element of what we can test for, but you really understood the cultural and the spiritual things that impacted their lives. And when you can do that, you build a lot more trust with patients, which again brings you closer to that. When you've got a trusting relationship with a patient, you're so much closer to having that inspiring moment when you know that all the knowledge that you have in your head about how this person's going to get better and how they're going to stay better, that's something you can deliver. So I think touching on those relationships in community and allowing you to have that over time and not just deal with things at the pointy end where you're sort of just trying to put a fire out, I think that's the kind of model of care we're talking about. In the States and working at MIT, seeing how you can take, and sitting on the board of Sheba, seeing how you can take innovation and test it and trial it in a safe way with the right clinical governance barriers from ideation through to clinic and focus on the outcomes that you want to have for the patient. I've seen it work. We've experienced it at Boston. We've experienced it at Human. And so I think paramount to that is creating an environment for clinicians to not have to choose between spending time on innovation and spending time on clinical care. The two should be synonymous and you should be supported to take experiments and, you know, try things with your patients without ruining trust, without affecting safety, and really be a part of the change without having to choose.
Sounds amazing. I feel like we could keep talking about this, but in the interest of time, I want to go back a little bit and go through a few different areas that you've talked about. Cool. And ask you the question of what advice you wish you could give to your younger self, possibly the 18-year-old, would you have gone and done medicine again? But also that thinking about leaving medicine and facing all of that uncertainty, is there something that you wish you could tell Steve from that point in time?
Yeah. I would choose medicine again, time and time again. I think people look at me and they say, oh, I bet you don't want your kid to be a doctor. I think medicine was the most incredible learning experience, and what a privilege that society gives you to be able to deal with people when they're at their most vulnerable and to work together to find solutions. So I don't for a second regret that experience and would do it 1,000 times over. I think probably though, leaving medicine or stepping outside of medicine, even while I'm in medicine for that matter, I think the best thing that I could tell my 18-year-old self is you realize that you're not the hero of the journey. There's a lot of A-type personality. We go out there, we get told, and rightly so, because when, you know, a met call happens and you're called to a room and you are the only person in the room, you better be able to handle it. It takes a lot to have the whole weight of the world on your shoulders. And when you remove that and you realize that collaboration is the key to some of the bigger problems, it allows you to do a couple of things. Firstly, oh my God, you can breathe. It's okay to do an internship. It's okay to take a year off. Go traveling. Go do a pottery class at night instead of studying for your surgical exams, you know, master's scuba diving course in Bali, because you never know where doing one of those little ventures out there where you get a different perspective on the world is going to be the thing that allows you to come back to medicine, to your patients, to your why, and have immeasurable change or vastly different perspective that means that your value is so much more. So take the bigger swings earlier. The second thing is when the whole weight of the world's not on your shoulders, you don't have to worry so much about, is this next move this exact one? Have I thought about every perspective? You just do it because there is no right move. You're going to create your own path. It's going to be unique. And because it's unique, you're going to be able to have a synergistic effect somewhere else down the line. And you just don't know. You can't plan for what that's going to be. So enjoy it a bit more. Take some more swings. That's what I'd tell my 18-year-old self.
Yeah, I love that. I feel like I read an article where that was described as building identity capital, which I love. Mm. Like the message was in your 20s, build identity capital. But I've recently turned 30 and I want to reject that we should save that for exclusively.
No, you can do it. A family friend of mine went back to medicine after a 30-year hiatus at 60 years old and retrained to be a GP. And now he's one of the greatest GPs with a wealth of empathy and experience in our community. It'll be there for you if you want it to be there for you. The doors don't close. They really, really don't. If you want to open a door, you can. And if you're in medicine and you've got to this point now, you're probably the kind of person with the capability and skills to open a whole range of doors you haven't realized. Your age is not going to affect that. Hopefully, it's not like something you do at 30 and then it's done once. Hopefully, it's part of who you are and you continually take those big risks. Because I think to your point, that identity capital, the weirder you are, the weirder you get, the more unique that experience is and the more valuable you become at the table when people want to create big change.
Yeah. I love that. Now, our final question we ask everyone that comes on the podcast is, if we were in an alternate universe, what would you do for your career outside of all of the things that you have done, assuming that the financials and the skills are not an issue?
Okay. I used to think it was go back to acting. Like, it was this big regret of mine that I never went to NIDA and I went to medical school and I thought, oh, I needed to be an actor. But spending time in different communities and learning about different people, I think there's certain elements of care that you can only deliver when you stop looking at it through such a rigid framework or scientific-based lens. And so I'd probably go and become like a rabbi and do pastoral care and spend my time thinking about like the big philosophical questions of life. Because when push comes to shove, like it's not always like a drug that's going to work. It's not always talk therapy that's going to work. It's not always an intervention that's going to work. Like sometimes, this is true for more than just mental health, I think. Like sometimes what people are looking for is, it's right in front of you and it's really human. And I think if I could spend my time doing that, maybe I would make a better mark on this world. And who knows, maybe one day Toga Health will be really, really successful and I can retrain as a rabbi, but we'll see.
I want to see that for your future.
We'll see.
Well, thanks so much for coming on the podcast, Steve. Cool. It's great to hear your story.
Oh, it's been great to do this. Thank you, Elise.
Thank you for listening to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast, a proud member of the Talking Health Tech podcast network. We hope that we'll see you at our upcoming conference, which is taking place Saturday, August 23rd and Sunday, August 24th in Melbourne. We will be bringing together inspiring speakers from all walks of medicine and an equally inspiring audience that we'd love to have you as a part of. Follow us on socials and subscribe to our newsletter so you don't miss any announcements. The Creative Careers in Medicine podcast acknowledges the traditional owners of country throughout Australia and recognises the continuing connection to lands, water and community. We pay our respects to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures and elders past, present and emerging.